I am Ken Rudin's father. I will do everything in my power to provide him with the love and support he deserves. I have been able to spend time with him during the past year and trust that future efforts to show him the love and affection he deserves can be done privately and in peace. Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm his son, Ken Rudin.
And Ken, I think this week we really need to give the listener a choice between topics. What do we say first? On the one hand, perhaps the most stunning Senate race upset of our time. Certainly one that's going to have...
Of all times.
And certainly one that's going to have ramifications beyond any one single Senate race I can think of in recent American history. I know your recent American history goes back further. And in addition to that, we also have a Supreme Court decision which blows up the restraints on corporations and, by extension, labor unions in terms of their spending on behalf of campaigns for any federal office. This is going to change the landscape of American politics overnight.
We also have the February 2nd primaries in Illinois.
And those are coming right up.
When?
At the end of this month, in the beginning of February. So
Let's start with Citizens United, because that's the most recent.
Just moments ago.
Beep, 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 beep.
This just in, the Supreme Court has blown up American politics as we know it.
Wow. Remember the coffee you had last week?
I'm still having it. First of all, what is the Citizens United versus FEC case, Ken? What are the facts?
Citizens United is a conservative organization that put together an anti-Hillary Clinton documentary during 2008.
Hillary the movie.
And they wanted to run it during the presidential campaign.
But late in the campaign before a particular primary, within 30 days.
Right, and not only that, with corporate money, and of course the Federal Election Commission, the FEC, said they could not do that. It would be a violation of campaign finance laws. So the Supreme Court took it up, and they were expected to have a decision last year.
Last year. That's right. Of course, our district court had originally said the FEC was right about this because they were applying the McCain-Feingold Act of 2002, signed into law by President Bush, passed by a bipartisan Congress. But when the Supreme Court took it up, the questions being asked by the justices, especially the new Chief Justice, John Roberts, made it clear they were not happy with the McCain-Feingold law or with the previous Supreme Court rulings on the McCain-Feingold law, and they were ready to get pretty rough in overturning it.
And with this week's decision, a 5-4 decision, all the unlimited spending that we saw certainly a lot of before the Watergate excesses could be back in politics in time for 2010.
Well, and even after Watergate, of course, we got the 527s, the soft money phenomenon, the ways that labor unions and corporations could get their money back into politics, even if they weren't giving directly to candidates and even if they weren't giving the kind of contributions they were prior to Watergate. That made it possible for them to really influence politics again and have a lot of money involved. Consider this hypothetical. What if Goldman Sachs, which has just given $16 billion in bonuses, what if they were to take some portion of that $16 billion and spend it on politics in a year, 2010, in which a major issue before Congress is going to be a tax on bonuses by investment banks like Goldman Sachs? I mean, what happens then if they want to spend, well, I don't know, maybe one out of those $16 billion on candidates who are willing to say they wouldn't support that tax?
Of course, both sides have the opportunity to do that. Now, labor unions could do any kind of lobbying they want and spending on candidates who are in favor of card check, things like that. What's amazing about this is that if you think of all the money that was spent in the more recent campaigns, 2008, Barack Obama spent more than any other presidential candidate in history, I guess.
That's right. A lot of it, of course, raised in relatively small amounts.
Right,
they
were small
internet
donors, but that may very well pale to what's going to come out in 2010. And there's so much at stake. The Republicans need 10 seats to recapture control of the Senate, 40 seats to recapture control of the House. And yet, with so much money now available, and as we saw in Massachusetts, anything is possible. Suddenly, a lot of races that were not on our radar screen may very well be competitive.
And that may have been true anyway, because we had this enormous shock to the system that came on Tuesday with the victory of Scott Brown, a state senator there in Massachusetts, previously pretty obscure, not really a household name even in Massachusetts.
Even in Scott Brown's household.
Winning out over State Attorney General Martha Coakley, the Democratic nominee, for the seat of Teddy Kennedy, which we've all said endlessly has been in the Kennedy family since 1952, perceived by a lot of people as an almost ancestrally Democratic seat, very blue state, so thought. And we talked about this in the podcast last week. Maybe Massachusetts is not so Democratic as it is non-Republican. But Scott
Brown,
Absolutely. Scott Brown, though, ran as a kind of independent. Many times said, I'm not running as a Republican. I'm running as an independent. I'm going to be the 41st senator, not just for the Republican minority, but for the independence of America. And I'm going to resist the Democrats' agenda. We were already thinking that the apple cart for 2010 had gotten a much rougher upset on Tuesday, even before this court decision brought all these God knows how many millions of dollars into the equation. And we were already talking about people like, say, Evan Bayh, who had looked very safe in Indiana, didn't have a major opponent, maybe getting a major opponent in Mike Pence because of the energy we saw in Massachusetts.
Well, there was an article this week in the New York Times about Bruce Blakeman, obviously a household name in Scott Brown's household. He is the unknown Republican, likely Republican challenger to Kirsten Gillibrand in New York. He could very well be the Scott Brown of New York. There may be a lot of Scott Browns. Several things you mentioned, though. We talked about Ted Kennedy's seat, and I think that's one of the reasons that Scott Brown hit a nerve in Massachusetts, because that big banner, Scott Brown was declaring victory on Tuesday night, it's the people's seat.
Yeah.
It's not Ted Kennedy's. It's not Benjamin Smith II. It's not Paul Kirk. It's not John Quincy Adams, who also held the seat. It's the people's seat, and I think that was a big deal. Plus, and we've mentioned this on the podcast before, when Paul Kirk, the interim appointee, said that even if Scott Brown wins this election, I'm going to vote for health care, people complain that our elected officials don't represent us. Here we are, Paul Kirk telling the people of Massachusetts, even if you're against health care, and I'm not sure if this was a referendum on health care or not, but even if you're against the health care plan, it doesn't matter. Even if Scott Brown wins and you vote for him and you elect him and all that stuff, I'm voting for it.
And I think there was some discussion of the Democrats trying to have some more votes on health care in the Senate before Scott Brown took the seat. In other words, delay his certification as the new senator just long enough to have the final votes on health care and get the bill through. It was clear that that was going to be a controversial kind of move. And now, as we know, the president and Harry Reid and everybody else all lined up and said, nope, we're not going to do that. We're not going to jam it through. It is still possible that the House could simply accept the Senate bill and obviate a conference and obviate any further votes by the Senate, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen.
Yeah, on Tuesday night, actually, when Jim Webb, the moderate centrist Democratic senator from Virginia, said we should not have any votes on health care at all until Scott Brown is seated, I think whatever plans, conspiratorially or not, that Harry Reid may have had about delaying Scott Brown swearing in fell by the wayside.
So now we have a Senate in which no one thinks there are 60 votes for the Democrats. I think we could argue that through the last several months, it's been a question mark whether there were 60 votes for the Democrats. I mean, they were relying on Joe Lieberman. They were relying on Ben Nelson. Sometimes those guys kind of went on their own direction. Joe Lieberman changed radically the nature of the Senate bill when he personally forced them to take out the public option. That's one reason the House can't just vote on the Senate bill and accept it.
First of all, there's tons of objections that House Democrats have, not only with other House Democrats, like on Stupak Amendment, but with Senate Democrats on public option, on taxes and things like that. But the Democrats had 60 votes, I guess, since Arlen Specter switched and since
Al Franken
was sworn in. And not that 8 months is a long time, plenty of time to pass a health care bill that has been stymied for 50 years. But when you think of the selfishness of the Ben Nelsons, the Joe Liebermans, the Mary Landrews, the people who had to be cajoled, persuaded, bought. Well, yeah. They had to wait for a wake-up call in Massachusetts. I mean, look, Joe Lieberman ultimately came on board. Nelson came on board. Landrew came on board.
And they probably all expected to do so sooner or later, but they were exacting their price first. They didn't care about the let's get this done before November, or for that matter, the August deadline initially. I think that was probably always unrealistic. But they didn't care about November. They didn't care about the Christmas deadline, which looked like a pretty big one, end of the year. They were willing to push this all the way to the brink, partly, largely, because they and we and virtually everyone else saw no chance that this special election in Massachusetts was going to go the way that it did.
You think of all the smart people who ran the Obama campaign, that they knew everything what to do. They outsmarted Hillary Clinton. They outsmarted John McCain. They knew exactly about the caucus system, about where the delegates were, how to win this. And yet, you could blame an inept candidate in Martha Coakley, but you could also blame the Democratic National Committee, the DSCC, the Obama White House saying, how could we never see this coming? And why do we suddenly have to have panic about health care on January 19th when we still had plenty of time to pass it and we couldn't pass it?
And also, though, I think there's another fundamental question here. Why is 59 not a majority out of 100, not enough votes to pass a piece of legislation.
Isn't that something?
Well, it is clearly a function of the United States Senate's rules and the fact that you can have unlimited debate and you can completely tie up a bill with just the threat of unlimited debate, also known as a filibuster. And as a result, Harry Reid is not willing to force those 40, 41 Republicans, however many, to actually filibuster.
Right. Remember when Jim Jeffords switched from the Republican Party to become an independent in 2001? It was a 50-50 Senate, and then it suddenly became a 51-49. And oh, my God.
Oh, the Democrats have a majority.
Now they only have 59 now. This is just unbelievable.
Well, here's the difference. At that time, all they were really trying to do is resist George W. Bush. Now they're trying to pass what has to be called an ambitious agenda. They're trying to revise the way health insurance and therefore the way the health care delivery system works. They're trying to re-regulate the financial industry. They're trying to push through a climate change bill with cap and trade or whatever other system it has in it. That's a big, big, tough push. They want to perhaps do another stimulus bill that would have to be put largely on the cuff because they don't want to pass tax increases. They want to tackle immigration in 2010. How can they possibly? They've forgotten about talking about some of big labor's agenda like the card check bill. I mean, they've forgotten about some of these aspects, but they are still trying to do the biggest, most ambitious elements of the president's agenda.
Sticking to the political aspect of this, if the Democrats can't hold on to a Senate seat in Massachusetts, and of course there are a lot of factors why Coakley didn't win and why Scott Brown did win, what does this portend for 2010 when the Democrats we knew were going to lose seats anyway?
Yes, and we expected them to have a tough go in Nevada with Harry Reid, in Arkansas with Blanche Lambert Lincoln. We expected it to be hard for them to hold on to Arlen Specter's seat because he's got both a primary and a tough general election coming up. We would think that Arlen Specter was in pretty good shape in Pennsylvania, except when you see the kind of energy that was out there on the right.
Don't forget
in
North Dakota with Byron Dorgan going.
I think
that's gone.
That's gone. I think that's John Hoeven's seat now. Yep. And I think that the Democrats are going to have to struggle to keep from losing, say, half of their remaining majority. And they could lose more than that. I don't think the Senate is quite in play yet until we start seeing guys like Evan Bayh in trouble.
Let me just say something about Evan Bayh. Evan Bayh, first of all, like Byron Dorgan, was on our safe list for the longest time. But he, you know, there are a lot of people in the Democratic Party who say that with the result in Massachusetts, it's time for Obama to stop being conciliatory with the Republicans, that he should go hard left and just force it down their throats. I mean, just, you know, we want this kind of legislation, fight for it. Evan Bayh says, no, the way to do it is we can't have a left-wing agenda in the Democratic Party. I wonder, one, there are rumors, of course, as you say, that Mike Pence may run, Congressman Mike Pence. I don't know if he's a statewide figure. I don't know if they know him in Indiana the way we know him in Washington.
No, but he would be the kind of guy who could mobilize the same kind of super intense support
absolutely.
That Scott Brown did.
And I wonder if the left is just so disenchanted with Evan Bayh. I mean, he's certainly not like his father, Birch Bayh, who was a doctrinaire
liberal.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Evan Bayh is basically a Republican running as a Democrat on many issues. And I'm wondering if the left sits out 2010, and I don't think that's going to happen, but if they sit it out in Indiana and the Republican right is energized behind a Mike Pence type, again, that's another seat that we never thought was in jeopardy.
The other reason that a guy like Mike Pence might not have been thinking he would run, or a guy like John Hoeven in North Dakota might have hesitated to run, was money. They were concerned about whether or not the money was going to be there. And in many, many, many House races, the big concern was that the Republican candidate was not going to have enough money challenging a Democratic incumbent. I think that concern is gone. Yeah. After Citizens United versus FEC. I think the Supreme Court has essentially said there will be money for any candidate who can attract corporate support. And that means that Republicans who thought, well, maybe the atmosphere isn't there, maybe the money isn't there, they've got their dreams and their prayers answered all in 1 week.
There are a lot of races that we weren't even looking at. Democrats are convinced that Harry Reid's Republican opponent, even though Harry Reid's numbers have never looked good in Nevada,
he's underwater. He's under 50% real.
Yes, but against the generic, nobody runs against a generic Republican.
That's right, and you can't rip up on a generic opponent.
Right, and a lot of people say these are not top-of-the-line candidates, but what is a top-of-the-line candidate anymore? And I wonder which is the approach that the Republican Party wants to go. It's one thing to have a nationally known or a well-known conservative figure like a Mike Pence, like somebody like that. But I think what helped Scott Brown is that he was the everyman. He was the truck driver. He was not somebody who's been toiling in the Republican, you know, fields for years and years and years.
And, in fact, they were careful not to have a parade of national Republican figures.
That would have been a disaster.
Coming into Massachusetts to campaign for him. And, in fact, Mitt Romney, a guy who got elected in Massachusetts as a Republican.
Right. Then he was a moderate.
And he has, you know, had several transformations since then, I understand. But Mitt Romney did not come in and try to take over and say, no, I'm, you know, Scott Brown's big daddy and I'm going to get him elected the way I got elected in Massachusetts. This was a totally different kind of campaign. He had JFK in his ads.
Right.
He was quoting JFK about capital gains tax cuts. I mean, he was really trying to be something other than a Republican. He was trying to be an independent candidate for the Senate.
And the Democrats thought they were very snarky and very clever about this, saying, where is Sarah Palin? Where is the National Republicans? Where is Michael Steele? Well, I think the real question right now is, where is Tim Kaine? If he's the Democratic National Chairman for the remainder of 2010, under his watch, Democrats lost New Jersey, lost Virginia, lost Massachusetts. Is it a referendum on Obama? Probably not. Is it good news for the Democratic Party? No, it can't be good news. Look, you can't blame Ronald Reagan for the Republicans losing the Senate in 1986, and perhaps you can't blame Obama for this, but if they didn't see it coming, if they still said, we need a wake-up call. After all this, after all the polling numbers, after the Tea Party, after the protests during the health care forums, town hall meetings last summer, if they still need a wake-up call in January of 2010, they may not be woken up in time for November.
I don't think this was a wake-up call. The wake-up calls are past. What happened this week in Massachusetts was not a wake-up call. It was the first evidence that this kind of opposition to Obama and the Democrats can crop up anywhere, that it can be extremely powerful in the absence of a decent Democratic effort and candidate, and that there's really no telling how far their losses can go in November.
Even if it's not opposition to Obama, it still ultimately is bad news for the Obama agenda in
That's
Congress.
Right. It's the agenda. Right. It's not a personal right. thing. This is about the substance of what the Democrats are doing. And it's also about the idea that the Democrats are in charge of everything and not delivering. And in case the Democrats hadn't had a bad enough week this week, they also got a bad jobs report. The number of people filing first-time unemployment claims went up. And it's supposed to be going down if we're actually in a recovery. And it's just going to have to change if the Democrats are going to hold off these losses we're talking about in November.
And you don't want to play politics with this, but look, just as in 2006, when the Democrats were in front of every gas station in the country pointing to $4 gas prices and saying, look, we're upset about this,
but are you aware of just how upset you ought to be?
Now, you know, look, Republicans are not going to be jumping up and down at 10% unemployment.
No, but they will talk about it a lot.
As they should, as Jimmy Carter did in 1976, as Ronald Reagan did in 1980, as Bill Clinton did in 1992. Too. The economic climate of the country is what elects or unelects certain political parties. And right now, with a 10% or a double-digit unemployment number, that's not good news for the Democrats.
Certainly was a factor in Massachusetts, along with all these other things. Now, there are some Republican question marks in November of 2010. There are probably a couple of House seats that they're holding relatively temporarily. Oh, they could give back a few. And in the Senate,
The lot of retirements. The Kit Bond seat is certainly still a toss-up in Missouri. The Ohio open seat that Voinovich is giving up is a question mark. Perhaps less so in New Hampshire, when the Republicans have a slight lead. But again, there are uncertainties on both parties, and Republicans do have their share of retirements as well.
They have six retirements, but are there any Republican incumbents who are in any kind of trouble in November, either through, you know, a threat in the general election or perhaps from a strong primary challenger? I know a lot of the Republicans have been acting as though they were afraid of primary challengers.
Well, we know that Bob Bennett in Utah, who is a conservative, may not be conservative enough for some Republicans out in Utah, and he is threatened with a battle at the state convention later this year. But again, there's no way the Democrats pick up that seat.
Is there any kind of a question mark over John McCain, or at least in terms of his identity at this point? I mean, there he is in Arizona. He's got an opponent on his right. And now he has this Citizens United decision, which wipes out the signal accomplishment of his entire time in the Senate.
I don't really know what the identity of John McCain is anymore. And I don't mean that critically. I just really, there have been so many incarnations of McCain. Go back to Keating 5, to the complete maverick when he ran against George W. Bush in 2000, to more of an establishment candidate in 2008. He lost some of that maverickosity, even though he picked what's-her-name from what's-his-state. it's part of a John McCain that no longer exists, actually.
He's had to shed that part of his identity. He really has.
Now, he has an opponent from Chris Simcox, one of the leaders of the Minutemen movement in Arizona. And
that makes him pretty conservative.
Yes, but again, you know, you have one of the first things that Senator-elect Scott Brown did was to tape a robocall for John McCain. John McCain and Scott Brown, in the same sentence, may not be the same kind of Republican, but in a sense, you talk about Scott Brown's upset in Massachusetts this week, this independent thinker, this new voice for the Republican Party. That's exactly what we used to say about John McCain going back to 2000. Speaking of money and politics, there's a Riel Hunter to talk about.
Yes. The last memory, perhaps, of John Edwards is going to be of him reading that statement that we parodied at the beginning of the show.
I always feel queasy about talking about sex scandals of politicians. I think there's a lot of reasons why it shouldn't affect anybody. I understand that there's a lot of things about hypocrisy that upsets a lot of people. But the thing that will always bother me about John Edwards, and hopefully this is the last thing I'll ever say about John Edwards, is that he was still campaigning for the Democratic presidential nomination and later was offering himself up as a running mate.
Strongly
as Barack
really
Obama.
Really making his bid.
While he was in the midst of this affair, and of course, had it broken in October of 2008 when he was on the ticket.
Blown a hole in the ship,
he
and down
brought,
goes the ship.
Absolutely. And while I'm not trying to make the case for the Democratic Party, anybody who is so selfish that they can be involved in something like that while selling themselves as a presidential candidate is just contemptible.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rutan.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Ma, ma, where's my pa?
Didn't make it to the White House. Ha, ha, ha.
Doggone girl is mine.
She's mine.
She's mine.
No, 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 she's mine.
The girl is 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 mine.
Mine, mine.
Yep, she's mine.
Mine, mine.
The girl is mine.
Mine, mine.
Yes, she's mine.